From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. It's hard to imagine anyone better suited to report on Iraq than Anthony Shadid. Although he's American-born, he's of Lebanese descent and is fluent in Arabic, and he's worked as a journalist in Iraq since before the U.S.-led invasion. His coverage of the Iraqi conflict for The Washington Post earned him the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting last year. Mr. Shadid incorporates much of that reporting in his latest book, which he calls Night Draws Near, and in which he examines the consequences the invasion has had on ordinary civilians in Iraq. It is published by Henry Holt. I'm very pleased it has brought Anthony Shadid to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
How long have you been reporting in Iraq?
You know, I first went there in 1998 as a reporter for the Associated Press, and then I went back in 2002 with the Boston Globe, and then I was hired by the Washington Post in 2003 and arrived in Baghdad, I think, a couple of weeks before the invasion itself, and then ended up staying afterwards.
Did the Iraqis you talked with know that you were an American journalist?
You know, I was always treated as a foreigner. The Arabic I speak is Egyptian Arabic, so it is a different dialect. And, you know, I was never a native. I was always an outsider, a stranger. I don't think I was always taken as an American, per se. You know, I think there are kind of degrees of difference of being an outsider, and I was sometimes in between.
At the same time, I'm sure your appearance and the fact that you could speak Arabic, even with an Egyptian accent, inspired more trust than it would have if I were standing there with an interpreter.
I think so. You know, and there's always that sense. I think language helps that, background helps that. You know, it's kind of maybe an odd phrase to use, but sometimes there's a shared memory, kind of a sense that you're going to understand what somebody's saying, and that often helped build that trust that's, you know, so essential in interviewing and getting people to talk to you.
Did things change as anti-American sentiment grew?
You know, I think what changed was the frustration and the confusion. You know, I think back to the families that I met during the war and then how our conversations went afterwards in those months that followed. And, you know, it was, I guess, the sentiment that I felt so powerfully expressed often was disorientation. I mean, people not understanding how things were the way they were. And that did bring a lot of confusion into our conversations.
There's been a lot of debate over whether journalists should be embedded or not. You were not.
I was not, no.
Was it a matter of thinking you could get the story better? Some of the embedded journalists told me that it was really just a matter of safety.
You know, I think there was a lot of planning that the Washington Post did beforehand that went into the preparation for the invasion. And we spent a lot of time putting people with military units. You know, I think the paper and I felt strongly that we had to have somebody in Baghdad as well. Somebody kind of, you know, seeing where the bombs, you know, how the bombs were dropped and then seeing where they landed. And there was a little bit of debate whether or not we were going to stay in Baghdad through the invasion. But you know, I think it turned out to be the right call. And it was, you know, I think there was a certain maybe reluctance on the part of some editors that we weren't going to hear the truth from people, that these people were living under Saddam. It was one of the century's worst dictatorships. And there was not that much people would actually say. But I think we were all surprised, especially after that first week of the invasion, that people were saying things. They were talking.
Well, you tell a story about working on a piece with a colleague as a U.S. military troop walked through an Iraqi town. He was with the soldiers, and you followed behind. What were you trying to discover by working that way?
You know, I didn't know what to expect from that story. The colleague was Tom Ricks, one of the great reporters at the Washington Post, and he had approached me about doing this story. He would stay with the soldiers. We'd walk through this neighborhood called Yarmouk, and he would walk with the soldiers, and I'd follow 50 yards, 100 yards behind and talk to the people. It sounded like a good idea to me, and so we went that next day, and we did that, and it was probably one of the most revealing moments I think I had as a reporter there. I wasn't hearing what the soldiers were saying, but you know, I was very much hearing what the Iraqis were saying after they passed. And you know, often it was, you know, sentiments that contradicted, that are all kind of jumbled together. Some people, I remember one person told me that he was happy to see the soldiers, that it, you know, it was better to have a dog rule them than to have Saddam in charge. Other people saw the soldiers as maybe helping bring a certain security after weeks and weeks of looting and lawlessness. But I think more powerfully, you felt this ambivalence about the prospect of occupation, the sense of kind of insult of foreigners in the streets with guns and in charge. And I remember one guy said to me, you know, I feel like they're walking over my heart. I feel like they're crushing my heart. And I think this was still really early on. This is before the insurgency began in full force. And, you know, it did give you that, it was a hint of what was ahead. It was a hint of how difficult this could be.
Well, in the lead up to the invasion, what were Iraqis telling you?
You know, I tell you, often I think it was cast in terms of I guess in the United States at least, in terms of this liberation that we were about to end, as I said, one of the century's worst dictatorships. The sentiment I felt so powerfully in those days before the invasion began was fear, was anxiety. I think a lot of people look back to the 1991 Gulf War and the damage that war wrought on infrastructure, that there were days and weeks without electricity and water. I think there's a fear that would be a repeat of that, that there might be a last stand by Saddam that would bring untold damage to the city and the country. But I think, and I'm probably linked, you know, I guess what I walked, when the invasion ended and I look back on those weeks, what I heard most powerfully was this fear of the aftermath, this fear of what would follow Saddam's fall. And I think Iraqis knew very well what would follow. They knew that there might be anarchy and chaos and lawlessness. In fact, one of the stories I did right before the invasion began was about Iraqis making a run on gun stores. And at the time I thought, well, maybe they're buying the guns to fight the Americans. I wasn't sure. But when I look back on that, I realized they were buying the guns to protect themselves from other Iraqis. They were afraid of this chaos.
Did anyone tell you he wished the Iraqis could have overthrown Saddam themselves?
You know, that was a sentiment that I didn't expect then, that I heard time and again.
And it would have been very different, obviously, for them, emotionally. But this is also an indication that they were powerless.
You know, I think there was a sense of shame that foreigners had to, I mean, the word's sometimes abused, but it was foreigners that had to liberate them. And, you know, you heard that, I think you heard that on April 9th, the day that Saddam's statue fell. I think you heard that in the months that followed, you know. I mean, the sense of powerlessness is it's a powerful sense. And I think it can be read in a lot of different ways. There's a widow I met during the invasion. She was a mother of eight. It was a life of hardship. And I remember she once described it to me. I think this was a week into the invasion, and she described it as that, you know, there was a play taking place. Actors were reading lines and she was a spectator. She was in the audience and she was watching this drama unfold. She said it to me during the invasion and she said it to me in the aftermath. I think she said it to me a few times, and I always thought it was a window on, you know, how some people saw the changes going on in the country around them.
My guest is Anthony Shadid, Shadid, winner of the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting, which has led to this book called Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War, published by Henry Holt. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Most Americans see this as a liberation of the Iraqi people from a terrible dictator. He was even compared to Adolf Hitler at one point. But I would have thought the Iraqis would have hated him because of the war that they'd had with Iran and the terrible toll that took on Iraq. How come no one talked about overthrowing him in the aftermath of that war?
You know, it's interesting that you bring up that conflict, because I think if people ask me why Iraq is as it is today, I would point back to that conflict as the thing that shaped the country more than any other event. I mean, you know, it always struck me that it was like World War I was to Europe. A conflict that reshaped the country from top to bottom in a lot of ways. And I think when you look back to the conflict, I mean, there's a lot of different levels to it. I mean, there is the one sense that it militarized the culture. One in five men were under arms. It introduced a certain culture of violence or a certain kind of politics of violence that I think still dominate today. It was brutal, a million dead and wounded on both sides. And then also the American relationship to Saddam during that conflict. And
it's we supported Saddam.
Exactly.
And did they resent us? Did they see the irony?
You know, I think the Americans, I think the U.S., both civilian and military leadership, when they entered Iraq, they brought a lot of baggage. And I think a lot of that baggage dates back to the conflict with Iran. One friend of mine, I remember her telling me that, you know, Saddam would have never lasted as long in power, she said, if the Americans hadn't supported him during the war with Iran. And, you know, I think it is a complicated relationship. You have U.S. support for Iraq during that conflict. You have this, you know, U.S. support for sanctions in the 1990s, a sense of Americans abandoning the Shiite uprising after the 1991 Gulf War. It all adds to this very kind of nuanced picture of what the United States intends to do or what its intentions might be. It's much more than the black and white of liberator.
And what was the impact of those sanctions, the U.N. sanctions? They were debated here. Some people said the only people who are hurt by these kinds of sanctions are the poor people.
You know, I think when we look back, it was, I'll tell you, as a reporter in the aftermath, after Saddam's fall, I never understood why the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, which was in charge of Iraq after Saddam's fall, I never understood why they almost intentionally didn't talk about the impact of sanctions. And to me, the sanctions had such a huge effect, huge impact on Iraq. Like you said, it was the poor suffered. It wiped out the middle class, basically, the impact of the sanctions. It wrecked, it crippled infrastructure, the infrastructure we're still trying to deal with today. And it also gave Saddam, in a way, a lot more power. The pie was shorter, or the pie was smaller, and with a smaller pie, he had more leverage over patronage, over paying off the people who were loyal to him and punishing the people who were against him. It was a pretty miserable record, to be honest, when you look back at it.
Did you meet anyone who admired Saddam Hussein, somebody who wasn't receiving any benefits directly as a result of the support?
You know, when I was writing the book, when I was writing Night Draws Near, I tried to keep a critical eye on the reporting, or maybe a critical eye on some of the preconceptions I had or the assumptions I brought to the table. And I think one of the biggest mistakes I made as a reporter going into covering this story was that, on the one hand, I think I underappreciated the depth of resentment of Shiites towards Saddam. I don't think I understood how deep that hatred ran among many of them. I think I also underappreciated a degree of support, and not among all, but a degree of support that he did enjoy among the Sunni Arab community.
Well, there were some people, were also treated unfairly.
That's right. And there were some people who feel like they've been unfairly tagged as Saddam supporters. But there was a degree of support. You know, not among the Sunni community as a whole. There was a certain segment of the Sunni community that Saddam lavished support on. And they were the Sunnis like him. They were from the countryside. They were often poor. They were often very traditional, very conservative. And that was the community that he lavished his patronage on, that delivered him a lot of his support before, especially in the years before the regime became basically kind of a family mafia.
Several of the Iraqis you got to know told you that the U.S. invasion was just the start of another foreign-inspired tyrannical regime for Iraq.
You know, I think that it's kind of what we were talking about, in this sense of not sure what U.S. intentions were.
So they didn't buy into the American rationale that they were being liberated from an evil dictator?
You know, liberation, it's such an easy word, and it's tossed around a lot in Iraq these days. And I think some people saw it as a liberation. I do. I think there was jubilation of Saddam's fall. Again, though, at that, when I stood in the street of Baghdad on April 9th, the day that statue fell, you heard this idea of liberation, you heard this idea of relief, that the invasion was over. I think a lot of people thought it was over. I mean, of course, it's still going on today, the war. But there was also, again, like I mentioned, this ambivalence over what was next, over the idea of an occupation. And, I don't think, it was never black and white to me. It was always this gray. And I think that gray was really powerfully expressed that day on April 9th, when Tom and I followed the soldiers through the streets a few weeks later. And then, in story after story, it was always, you always reluctant, I think, as a reporter, I was always reluctant to say something was clear-cut, because it rarely was.
Well, you quote a speech from the British Major General Sir Stanley Maude from 1917. He said, "Our armies do not come into your cities and lands as conquerors or enemies, but as liberators."
You know, I was sitting in—
Did people remember that?
They remember that very well. And I was sitting in a gallery, an art gallery, and I think this was 2 days before before the invasion began. And I had mentioned something that President Bush had said in a speech a few days earlier, and I think the line was something along the lines, we come as liberators, not as occupiers. And one of the artists, he shouted, "That's exactly what Maude said." And I had no idea who Maude was. And I went back to the hotel, and I looked up the background, and it's what you just read. This was General Maude, who was the— he entered Baghdad at the end of World War I in 1917 and seized it from the Ottoman Empire. And he gave this very interesting speech. It was a very long speech, and some of it echoed very closely what President Bush said. And I think Iraqis often mention that line. They often shorten it to that, we came as liberators, not as conquerors. But they also remember what followed that statement, and that's that the British stayed in control of Iraq for a long time, controlled Iraq's oil, determined the political system that would rule Iraq. And I think that the words echoed so much, I think there was maybe a suspicion that the aftermath might echo each other as well.
Do you think that more people in Washington should have been aware of this history?
They should have read the speech by Ma, because it is so, it's uncanny. I mean, when you read it, it is kind of surprising how much of it is echoed in some of the rhetoric today. I think back, I didn't know that much about Iraq when I first came as a reporter in 1998. And so in a way, it was, I was learning about the country as well. And, I think back to the thing that surprised me most, the history that we probably didn't appreciate, was was the trauma, was the brutalization that went on, you know, under in those 20 or 30 years before the invasion itself, the war with Iran, like we've been talking about, the sanctions, Saddam's rule itself. You know, I think back to this
war against the Kurds.
The war against the Kurds, Halabja, the mass graves in southern Iraq. I mean, it is a history that is breathtaking in its brutality. And, you know, I think back to, there's this one doctor I met, Dr. Shehla, and who I got to know. And, you know, I remember her, there was always a sense of loss about that Iraq would never come back to what it was because of this record. And she told me one story that when she was a schoolgirl during the war with Iran, all the children were asked to leave the school, and they went into the street, and they watched these Iranian prisoners of war being paraded in pickup trucks, and people were urged to throw shoes at them, to spit on them, to shout insults at them. And I remember even as a schoolgirl, she said she realized that what she was watching meant the Baghdad she once knew was never going to come back. It was lost forever.
Well, also those people, those POWs were Shiites, and the majority of Iraqis are Shiites, so that must have been greeted with mixed emotions by them. But it's amazing how many miscalculations Saddam made. He attacked Iran, and that was a big mistake, and then he went to Kuwait.
Yeah.
And yet the Iraqi people didn't seem to hold him accountable.
You know, I think there was a certain degree of accountability, but there was no way to exercise that accountability. What do I mean by that? I think, you know, let me put it this way. I think if the United States had gone to Baghdad in 1991, I do think it would have been a different story. Not a completely different story. I think there are some things that are inherent in an occupation. I think some things are inevitable in that kind of relationship of occupier to occupied, that relationship that was perceived by many Iraqis.
But you mean as a direct result of the invasion of Kuwait, the Iraqis would have understood this was a legitimate response.
I think that's right. And I think what happened in the 1990s forever changed Iraq. The sanctions, the Shiite uprising, what happened to the Kurds in the north. It was a much different country in 2003 than it was in 1991.
Well, what about the rationales for going to war, the links to terrorists, the weapons of mass destruction? Did most of the people in Iraq know that really wasn't true?
You know, I think, you know, I guess I suspected it. I think a lot of Iraqis suspected that there were some weapons, but not that the threat was nowhere what the Americans were making it out to be. And in fact, I remember, it's interesting, you know, I think this is probably more 2002 when I was there with the Boston Globe, but I remember people being kind of shocked that Iraq was always at the top of the bulletin of the BBC. You know, it was always the main news item. And they were like, I think a lot of Iraqis saw their country as kind of pathetic by 2002, that it was not a threat. And I remember one woman said to me that God had cursed Iraq by giving it oil. You know, if it didn't have oil, it would have avoided a lot of the problems that it encountered over the past 80, 90 years.
My guest is Anthony Shadid. His book, Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. It's published by Henry Holt. We will continue our conversation after this. I'm Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking with Anthony Shadid, Shadid, winner of the Pulitzer Prize in 2004 for international reporting, now author of a book called Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War, published by Henry Holt. President Bush has spoken frequently about bringing freedom to the Iraqi people, but weren't the people you spoke to more interested in justice?
You know, I think that's a powerful idea that you hear in Arab rhetoric or even Muslim rhetoric, this idea that, you know, you hear the word justice more often than freedom. And justice can be a very elastic term, and I think justice is obviously more intensely felt by people who feel that they're being dealt injustice.
Does this reflect, do you think, a difference between Arab and Western cultures?
I think it has a grounding in religion. I do. I think the concept of justice as a much longer kind of resonance has shaped Islamic law in a way, has shaped kind of perceptions of rule and of, you know, those who rule and those who are ruled. Freedom, I mean, even in Arabic, it's a more recent term, and it's a term that, you know, I don't want to overstate this, but at a certain level is translated from the West, and it's definitely not a notion that has shaped politics to the degree that justice has.
The Iraqis you interviewed for this book spoke repeatedly about wanting to preserve their pride and their dignity. So did the occupation equal humiliation in their minds?
I think to a lot of people it did. I think especially in the areas where the insurgency, you know, it had almost kind of gained a momentum of its own. I mean, I think when we saw the military interact in these very traditional, very conservative areas of Iraq in the west and in the north along the Tigris and Euphrates, you know, it is a deeply conservative area. And these notions of pride and dignity and honor, they go very deep. Often there were these small slights. I mean, that the Americans would enter a room where there are only women, for instance, which Iraqis found a great insult. And that slight would become a provocation. That provocation would become a vendetta, and these vendettas would linger on for months and months. And, you know, I think to Fallujah, for instance. Fallujah wasn't a stronghold of Saddam. I think it's often cast that way, but it really wasn't. It later emerged as a symbol of the insurgency, but I think in the beginning it was often a series of vendettas.
So that, that disrespect of Iraqi women played a part. Men also complained about having had to bow to American military personnel, the humiliations of being taken off with things put over their heads and then paraded through town. How much difference would it have made if there had been some cultural sensitivity, at least at the start of the occupation?
You know, I think about that all the time, and that's a question that I haven't been able to answer. You know, was what we've seen come out of this inevitable? And I don't know that. I mean, a lot of this does feel inevitable to me, that when you have this kind of relationship, that these things are almost expected. Part of it, though, doesn't feel inevitable. I mean, if it had been done differently, if Baghdad wasn't looted in the aftermath, if it wasn't wrecked, if more soldiers spoke Arabic, if they were able to talk to people in their own language, if they had a better sense or a better appreciation of what would create an insult, I guess I do think it may have been different. I think some of this stuff was probably inevitable. You would have probably had an insurgency regardless, but it may not have been the insurgency that we're seeing today.
Did the overthrow release a Pandora's box of problems that had been repressed by Saddam?
Well, see, I think that's the thing I come away with, having spent my time there, is that, you know, there is this debate, is it a liberation or is it an occupation? And, you know, it's a little of both, it's a little of neither. But what was most powerful to me of what the United States did in Iraq was it was a catalyst for these consequences that none of us, I think, anticipated, this idea of a religious revival, for instance, of this growing militancy within the insurgency that I think we've only seen the preamble to in a way, and this hardening of lines between sect and ethnicity, between Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds. I mean, these are all forces that are reshaping Iraq beyond, I think to this point, beyond the control of anyone else there.
Would that religious revival have been predictable? After all, we saw it in former communist countries where after years and years of suppression of religion. We've seen it in Turkey as well, that when things are eased up immediately, people become more religious than they might have otherwise.
I think that's right. I think there were hints of it before the invasion. There really were. I mean, there was a sense of Iraq and Baghdad in particular becoming a more religious society. And I think you're exactly right. And these, you know, in a vacuum of authority, you know, new forms of authority rise, or new forms of solace, or new. I mean, religion is often, you know, this. It is a form of comfort in a way, and I think it often can very powerfully meet that need. I think what was probably least expected, though, was perhaps the rise of the Shiite clergy after the invasion. I mean, I don't think we appreciated that it was the only institution that had survived Saddam. I mean, most other institutions in that country had been destroyed or wrecked or crippled. The clergy was intact, and it did, in a very powerful way, rise up to fill the vacuum that followed Saddam's collapse.
Some people have talked to me about the symbolism of the occupation, the fact that the soldiers are now living often in the old palaces, Saddam's palaces, and that they use Saddam's hated prisons as the prisons that they brought prisoners to, Abu Ghraib being the worst example.
You know, I think that, you know, I think in that what we were talking about earlier, this idea of being a spectator, you know, watching a drama unfold, and it fits, you know, that notion of a new ruler in the same palaces, I think kind of fits that, the sense of powerlessness, that we're watching this drama unfold, we're watching a new ruler in these palaces, you know, kind of controlling life in an arbitrary fashion. There is a certain continuity to that. I don't want to compare the two by any means, but I think just in a notion of impressions, of watching from afar, of the sense of powerlessness, it does continue today.
And then there were the promises that there'd be increased prosperity, security, that the electricity would be back on in a short time. Saddam was able to restore electricity in Iraq only 18 hours after the Gulf War, We're still hearing of electrical shortages today.
You know, I think when somebody writes the history, I mean, somebody writes the history of the American experience in Iraq, I mean, chapter one is going to be electricity. It's amazing the power and the influence that the lack of electricity has had on Iraqi notions about this experience or this project. You know, I think back to Karima, who I mentioned earlier, this widow who I had met during the invasion, and you know, it's the challenges they face. They're sometimes mundane, and sometimes they're hard to write about as a journalist. But you know, not having electricity for a couple of days when it's 130 degrees outside, carrying water up two flights of stairs because there's no running water inside. You know, one of her daughters was almost kidnapped. Four car bombs went off in front of her house. I mean, these challenges are overwhelming, and they're in a way suffocating. And you know, people talk a lot about democracy. People talk a lot about liberation, about freedom. I think a lot of Iraqis talk about, you know, an end to the deprivation and a better life in a way.
Iraqis blame the U.S., some of them anyway, for the looting that took place after Saddam's fall. And some of the people you spoke to thought the United States was deliberately not fixing the electrical power system because it seemed impossible that such a powerful country would be unable to solve such a simple problem.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, I was there during the invasion, and I think other journalists, Iraqis that were in the city, watched this campaign unfold with incredible prowess. And I mean, especially that first week of the invasion, the bombing was precise. And I think I was struck by it. And there weren't a lot of civilians being killed in Baghdad in that first week. It became much less precise as the invasion dragged on. And the last days of the invasion were incredibly bloody. But I think we all came away with a certain awe of the U.S. military, that it could topple a regime that had been there for more than three decades in less than 3 weeks at relatively little loss of American life. And I think the Iraqis watching that were expecting that same prowess in the aftermath, and instead what they saw was Baghdad being wrecked. I mean, Baghdad wasn't destroyed during the invasion. In some neighborhoods, you had to actually look for the damage. It was wrecked in the aftermath. That looting, there were mornings that we would wake up, and Baghdad literally felt like it was burning.
Well, could we have done a better job? Could we have protected Baghdad? Could we have gotten the electricity up any quicker?
I think, you know, I guess I have a couple of thoughts. I mean, I think that looting, those weeks of lawlessness that followed Saddam's collapse, shaped sentiments more than any other single event. And I think they set the occupation on a certain path that it hasn't veered away from. Could we have done differently? You know, I guess looking back on that, the fall of Saddam was seen as the centerpiece of this whole thing. That, you know, once Saddam was toppled, then the American that was the goal of the American project there. Of course, what we've seen is the aftermath is the centerpiece of this project, the insurgency, the occupation. But I don't think there was a notion of that beforehand. And like I said, part of me wonders that if what we're seeing now is not the preamble to something even bigger that we have yet to understand.
Well, we're planning to have Iraqis take over a lot of the responsibilities. I've wondered every time I've heard about a suicide bomber blowing him or herself up at a recruitment site for Iraqi police, why anybody would even come and apply for the job now.
You know, and I think it goes back to this question of deprivation that I was talking about earlier. The experience of Karima's family, for instance, and one of her sons-in-law, in fact, is a policeman. They're the best jobs right now. You know, they pay the best at this point. And there's whole neighborhoods where everyone between 18 and 30 is trying to get a job as a policeman or as a soldier simply because it pays between $300 and $500 a month, which is an enormous salary.
But considering the anti-American feelings, are they seen as collaborators, as traitors?
I think some of them are. I think it's a different story in some of the Shiite areas where, you know, there's not as much animosity toward them. But if you go to a place like Beji, for instance, where I was a couple of months ago, there's a great deal of animosity toward them. They are seen as collaborators. And I think some of the soldiers are torn between these conflicting loyalties. I remember I did a story, and it's a part of the book as well. Pardon me, last year where I was talking to a group of police recruits, and they were talking about these conflicting loyalties, how they were torn between two sides. And one of them was talking about how the cleric in the mosque had declared them bad Muslims for taking part in this police force, for working with the Americans. And I asked him, I said, well, do you consider yourself a bad Muslim? He said, well, yeah, I am a bad Muslim. I shouldn't be cooperating with the Americans, but I have no other choice. I have to feed my family, and if the cleric in the mosque would pay my salary, then I would quit. And I think it struck me that he actually considered himself betraying his faith for doing what he did, but he had no other choice except to try to earn a living.
Well, everybody seems to be understanding that what they're doing isn't always going to succeed. You say the insurgents realize that they can't defeat the U.S.-led military coalition on the battlefield. but they continue to press their case. What is their goal?
You know, it kind of hits. I think it points to what you were saying earlier. You know, about these car bombs being detonated. You know, among a group of recruits. I mean, I was in Karbala, and it's the Shiite holy city. And I was there in February 2004, and it was a day when there was a series of suicide bombings, I think 7, 8, I forget the exact number. But it was unbelievable carnage, probably the greatest loss of life at that point, although there have been greater tolls since. And, you know, I sat there and tried to make sense of it to myself. I tried to understand why this was happening. And, you know, and it struck me that, you know, the point was simply a spectacle. And I think certain currents within the insurgency understand that they will never defeat the U.S. military on the battlefield. But that's not the point. They want to create a perception of failure, a perception of chaos, a perception of anarchy. And to create that perception, they have to keep creating spectacles. And spectacles, almost by their very nature, demand even greater loss of life each time to keep creating that spectacle. I mean, I think back, you know, 20 dead in a car bomb in 2003 was a banner headline in the Washington Post. And today it's a quiet day in Baghdad. And there's a brutal logic that goes into creating these spectacles. And a lot of people are being killed so that they're made.
Well, you interviewed the family of one of the earliest Iraqi insurgents, a man named Adnan Fadawi, and they told you that his corpse had no smell because he was a martyr, that hours later his blood had not congealed. So is the goal to create a martyr, or is the goal to attack American troops and their Iraqi supporters?
You know, as reporters, we often, you know, use these shorthand descriptions, and insurgency is one of them. It's not a real accurate term because there are many insurgencies. There are many currents within those insurgencies, and I think different insurgencies have different goals. I think one current within that insurgency focuses on the spectacle that we're talking about. I think Fadawi, the person you mentioned, was a different kind of insurgency, and it struck me how they operated in their towns and villages. You know, they saw themselves as fighting a religiously sanctioned battle. It wasn't a battle for Saddam. It was a battle for faith. It was a battle for nationalism. And, you know, there's another guy who actually lived in a village near Fadawi. And I remember I was trying to understand why he did what he had done. Some people said it was because of religion, you know, that he saw it as a religious obligation to fight the occupier. Some people said it was nationalism, that he was just ashamed to see American troops controlling his country. Some people said he did it for money. You know, Baathists had paid him hundreds of dollars to carry out this attack. And, I was struck when I went back to Baghdad to write the story. I didn't know the answer. It's probably some of the, you know, it might have been a little of the above, none of the above. I wasn't really sure. But, you know, I realized it didn't matter in the end because it was how he was perceived. And like you mentioned, some of these perceptions that, you know, he had become a martyr in the aftermath. He had become a hero in a way. And, you know, his record in life paled before his record in death. And in the end, that's what mattered. There was a certain myth that was being created.
Well, you purchased a videotape that was watched by some people before they went to their martyrdom as they were preparing for it. And it was interesting because it showed scenes of Palestinians suffering at the hands of Israelis mixed with images of American armored vehicles crashing through Baghdad. So is that what's happened? Is this insurgency now a little bit of Palestine, a little bit of Chechnya, a little bit of Afghanistan, a little bit of Bosnia? We are the poor Arabs who are always under attack by people from the West?
You know, I think it's one of the most powerful, like, kind of legacies of all this is that the idea of toppling Saddam was, we create a new country, we create a beacon for the rest of the region. Iraq would influence the rest of the Arab world. And especially in those, when I was working on that material, talking to those people, what struck me was it wasn't Iraq influencing the rest of the Arab world, it was the Arab world influencing Iraq. And, you know, you mentioned the CD. I mean, these CDs were never available before 2003.
Now you can buy them at any shop.
That's right. Cassette tapes of people like Abdelhamid Kishk, a famous Egyptian, very militant preacher, Abu Qaqa, a radical Syrian preacher, they were flooding across the border. And they were new influences in Iraq, and they were shaping the insurgency to a certain degree. I think these, you know, the images, the symbolism, they're very malleable, and they can be very adapted to local conditions, and that, I think, is what we're seeing with parts of the insurgency.
A brother of one of the insurgents who died told you that America's goals is to protect Israel, control Iraq's oil, and destroy Islam. That's a pretty heavy agenda, and I assume that he was not alone in that. But one Muslim also told you revenge is part of our tradition. Does that lead one to think that the gulf between the Americans and the Iraqis is or may be unbridgeable?
You know, I've asked that question, and I think when you look back at the baggage the United States brings. I think when you look back at the trauma that Iraqis have gone through, the brutalization, I think when you look back at the sense of culture under siege and the impact of an occupation on that chasm between the two sides, like I said, part of me does feel that some of these things may have been inevitable. You know, could it have been less intense? Could there have been something that we've done differently that would have made it, you know, more possible to succeed in some areas, if not all areas? I think that is possible. But I do think some of these things that we're witnessing today may have been inevitable at a certain level.
You can read an excerpt from Night Draws Near in our reading room. Just go to quicklinks at WNYC.org. Anthony Shadid will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7:30 at the Barnes & Noble store on 82nd Street and Broadway. And the book is Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War, based on his Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting. It is published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of The Leonard LoPate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.